Welcome to Lecture 19, Nature's Nuclear Reactors. In the previous lecture, we saw that the mass of a star determines its properties, its radius, its luminosity, its surface temperature, things like that. And in particular, I focused on the luminosity of the star, the power of the star, and how more massive stars emit far more energy per second than less massive stars. We will see later why that's the case, but they're pushing down on their cores a lot, and you need a lot of nuclear reactions to keep the star puffed up, to keep it hot inside. So mass is the single most defining property of a star. We saw that in a cluster, stars are initially born with a whole range of masses, and they populate the main sequence, the hot, luminous stars all the way down to the cool, dim ones. And the hot, luminous ones burn out more quickly than the cool, dim ones. So we saw that the length of the main sequence, how far up it goes in luminosity or temperature, determines or can tell us the age of the cluster. Now, I asserted that O-type stars, very massive stars, live for only about a million years. B-type stars, perhaps for 10 million years. A-type stars for maybe 100 million years, something like that. In this lecture, I'd like to discuss how it is we know that. We might get a cluster like this and populate or plot the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram and see that the main sequence does not extend all the way up to O stars and B stars. So we might conclude in a qualitative sense that the cluster is not brand new. It wasn't just born. But how do we turn that into a quantitative statement? What allows me to put numbers like 1 million, 10 million, 100 million on graphs like this? How do we figure out the time scale over which stars burn out? And how do we figure out what those stars turn into after they burn out? And the time scale over which they do that, the time scale over which they evolve. In this lecture and in the next few lectures, we will study stellar evolution, stellar structure and evolution, and learn answers to these questions. Well, to determine the evolution of a typical star, one might want to look at a whole population of stars having different ages. Newborn ones, adolescent ones, older ones, and ones that are about to die. In a way similar to that which a person would use when studying, say, human development, human growth and development, and behavior patterns. You wouldn't just pick one person from birth and study that one person all the way through their life. That would take too long. You'd never get your PhD thesis submitted, for example. Moreover, what if the one person you chose was not representative of all people? Instead, what you would do is take a whole bunch of newborns, a whole bunch of adolescents, a whole bunch of older people and the elderly, and assume that one type, one group of people evolves statistically to behave and look like the next group. All right? That's the way you would do that kind of a study, to complete it in a reasonable amount of time and to get a representative sample of people, to get a representative behavior. So in a similar way, to study the evolution of stars, we look at stars having a wide range of ages. And this is why clusters are so important, because we can choose clusters having a wide range of ages. Moreover, clusters have a large number of stars within them. And so we get a representative sample of what stars behave like if we look at clusters. This is why clusters are so important. We can determine their ages, and there's a bunch of stars in the cluster, so we can tell what statistically stars do at a given age. From such studies, we've deduced the following. Stars form out of gigantic clouds of gas and dust, like this Orion nebula in the Sword of Orion, shown here horizontally so that it looks better on the TV screen. This is an enormous cloud of gas and dust, maybe 1,500 light years away, something like that. And it is massive enough to be gravitationally contracting, very slowly initially, but then it sort of speeds up as it gains momentum. You know, it initially the gas is all spread out, and it finally coalesces into a clump that becomes gravitationally unstable, and it starts to contract. All the particles pull on all of the other particles. And if we look at that process then in more detail, we see that in the central regions, the gas breaks up into clumps, into particularly dense clumps, sort of fragments. And those clumps form individual stars. They merge together a little bit in this diagram. But there are individual stars here. And here's some that formed out of the cloud that used to be in this region here. But that cloud has now completely formed stars, and the remaining stuff has been blown away largely. So these stars form in the dense cores of giant clouds of gas and dust. Often these are called giant molecular clouds because the gas is so dense that it actually even combines to form molecules. The molecules can emit radio waves and infrared radiation, and we can study these giant molecular clouds and their contracting phases in most detail using radio waves and infrared radiation. In part because that's the radiation that these clouds emit, and also in part because the clouds are so dense and so dusty that optical light doesn't pass very easily through them. Here's an example, again, with the Orion Nebula. On the left panel, you see the main part of the optical nebula and a smaller part of the optical, that is, visible nebula. And it looks like in between there's nothing, right? You see hardly anything there, maybe one or two stars. So that's at visible or optical wavelengths. But if you look at infrared wavelengths, you can see that in this gap between the two main clouds, there and there, you see quite a few stars. Those are stars that are newly formed, or in some cases are still forming. And you can't see them at visible wavelengths because so much junk, so much smog, blocks our view. But you can see them at infrared and radio wavelengths. So those wavelengths are very useful for studying star formation. Well, another excellent example of this process is the so-called Eagle Nebula. There you see again a big cloud of gas. It's all lit up. And in some of the central regions here, you have very dark lanes, very dense, dusty gas. I claim that's where stars are right now forming. All right? Those are the densest parts of this cloud, and stars are still forming there. To the left, to the upper left, you see a cluster of stars that formed recently from what used to be the larger, you know, the extremities of this giant nebula, this cloud. So there's a cluster that recently formed, and it has cleared away much of the remaining gas and dust, so now we can see it. And here's the rest of the nebula, and there is the central, densest part of the nebula, which is still forming clouds. And a beautiful, detailed picture of this part of the nebula was taken with the Hubble Space Telescope. You can see these pillars of creation, they're sometimes called. These are dense clouds. You can't even see through them at optical wavelengths. Look at that. They look dark. Surrounding them, there's less dense material, which is lit up by some nearby stars, in some cases newly formed stars. But these dense fingers or pillars are where stars are forming right now. And if you look into those pillars with infrared telescopes or radio telescopes, you can see the clouds of gas that are contracting and in some cases already have formed stars. So that's where newborn stars form, in these giant clouds. If we look at the process schematically, it sort of looks like this set of diagrams. You have this giant cloud, and it starts contracting due to gravity. And then it fragments by a process that we still don't fully understand. Indeed, much of star formation we still don't fully understand. So I'm just giving you the qualitative details here. But it fragments, and these fragments collapse, essentially in free fall. It's as though you just drop a ball, all right, and it just falls because of Earth's gravity. But there, the fragments collapse due to the mutual gravitational attraction of all the particles in those clouds for all the other particles. And essentially, that's just simply free fall, like that. But eventually, as the cloud becomes dense, all the freely falling particles in this protostar, in this freely falling cloud, they start hitting each other. They start interacting. They start bouncing off of each other like this. And some of their energy of free fall, energy of motion downwards, gets converted into random energies, into random motions every which way. They start just colliding with each other, hitting each other, and they start going every which way. And that is the process which we associate with pressure. A gas exerts pressure when the atoms and molecules move every which way with some characteristic speed that depends on the temperature of the gas. The greater the temperature, the greater are the speeds. And all this random motion then exerts a pressure. So when these little fragments start becoming dense enough, they do begin to exert a pressure on each other, and the collapse, the free fall collapse, slows down. Now, normally, such a contracting cloud will have a little bit of spin. Rarely would you have a cloud that's out in space and is not turning at all. Normally, they would turn simply because there's interactions from one cloud to another, or because the whole galaxy is spinning, or for whatever reason. They have a little bit of spin. As they contract, that rate of spin increases because the size of the cloud decreases. We discussed this already under the nebular hypothesis when we considered the formation of the solar system. And the rate of spin is large, so it keeps the particles spread out in the equatorial plane of the spin. The spinning plane is spread out, kind of like the example I gave before, where you're on one of these, you're at one of these amusement parks on a rotating wheel, and you feel plastered to the walls of the rotating wheel as it's spinning, and sometimes the wheel operator will even turn it this way, so that you're actually sort of floating like this above the ground, but you don't fall because you feel plastered by this. It's called the centrifugal force. It's a force you feel in a rotating frame, and you feel plastered against the walls of this rotating gizmo. So along the plane of rotation, a disk develops, as shown in this diagram, and perpendicular to the plane of rotation, gas is more easily able to fall in. So you develop a disk like this, and then the star forms and it enters an especially active young phase. Stars churn out a lot of radiation and particles like the solar wind when they're very young. And that solar wind is able to most easily escape along the poles of this spinning disk, because it's hard for the gas to pummel its way through this disk. Okay, so the stuff tends to be emitted along poles, and that's how the star gets rid of the surrounding gas that's sort of left over. And at least theoretically, you're left with a star surrounded by a spinning disk of gas and dust, and that spinning disk, in principle at least, might coalesce to form planets. So this is the idea. You've got this collapsing cloud. It's spinning. A disk forms. A star forms at the center. It blows stuff away from it during an active early phase. Then planets somehow coagulate first you get planetesimals, and then they form planets. And voila, you have a planetary system. That's theory. Well, what do we actually see when we look in the innards of one of these contracting clouds of gas and dust? We see something that at least qualitatively conforms with theory. Here are a bunch of newly formed or still forming stars in the middle of the Orion Nebula. And these were photographed with the Hubble Space Telescope. There's a star, and there's a star, there's another one. And notice that in many cases, in all of the cases shown here, the star appears to be surrounded by a disk of dark material. Usually this disk appears elliptical in shape, but the ellipses have different eccentricities. Some are long and skinny, some are more circular looking. And we believe that these are simply circles, circular disks, viewed at cockeyed angles. When you view a circle from an offset angle, it will look like an ellipse. So we see that indeed, young stars and stars which are still forming are in many cases surrounded by the disks that would be expected to form if you had a spinning cloud of gas that's contracting. In some cases, we even see the disk nearly edge-on. Here's a picture which shows the edge-on disk, and in some colors, like the infrared, you can actually even see part of the star peeking out a little bit on the right-hand side here. But this is an edge-on so-called protoplanetary disk in the Orion Nebula. If it were seen more face-on, it would look more like the ones that I showed in the previous slide. All right. We've seen very nice examples of this recently. Here is a very recent picture, just published in 1998, of one of these edge-on protoplanetary disks. And this case is especially exciting because between the star and the outer parts of the disk, there appears to be a deficit of material. See, it doesn't look as bright right there and right there. This could be because planets have already formed or are still, you know, are forming, in the process of forming, in those regions, using up the gas and dust that happens to be at those particular locations. So this might be one of these protoplanetary disks that's in a reasonably advanced stage of planet formation, where you actually see some of the stuff used up already. And this is a picture taken at infrared wavelengths. The infrared and radio are particularly suitable for these sorts of studies. You see almost nothing optically at this location because everything is still cloaked in a massive, dusty, gaseous cloud. Here you can see jets of material being blown out from the region of star formation. And a close-up shows the newly formed or still forming star, and indeed, material appears to be thrown out preferentially along the axis of the jet, the axis of the disk. You can see that especially well in this left-hand picture here, where apparently we see an edge-on disk. There it is. It looks dark, very dense in that central part, slightly less dense and illuminated by some stars in the outer part. But here's an edge-on disk, and lo and behold, the material is indeed emitted preferentially along the axis of the disk, as theory would suggest, simply because it's hard for material to pummel its way out through the disk. These are called Herbig-Harrow objects, HH, and they are commonly associated with regions of star formation. And these are sometimes seen at optical wavelengths because by this time the star has successfully cleared out a reasonable fraction of the material around it, and you can begin to see the star at optical wavelengths. Okay? So the qualitative ideas of star formation appear to be confirmed. The quantitative details are very thorny. You know, you've got all this collapsing stuff, and it's interacting with other stuff, and it's hard work, all right? There's a number of theorists working on this, but always in conjunction with the observations. Science kind of goes that way. We've seen over and over again in the history of science that rarely do we make huge breakthroughs through pure thought alone. There are just too many possibilities nature could have adopted, or seemingly so. So we need some experiments, we need some observations to help guide us. All right, well, let's look at the last stages of this contracting protostar. I said that when it becomes thick enough, the gases start interacting with each other, hitting each other, and they start exerting a pressure. They start really hitting each other. And that slows the collapse down. In fact, it brings it almost to a halt. At this point, we call the star a pre-main sequence star. It was a protostar when it was still collapsing easily. But when it's starting to kind of slow down and you've got a spherical ball there and it's gradually contracting, we call it a pre-main sequence star. Why does it continue contracting? Well, it continues contracting because all these little particles are hitting each other and radiating energy. You know, when I drop a whole bunch of balls, they hit each other or they hit the floor, and the collisions radiate energy. The collision of the ball with the floor releases some of the energy of the ball. That, in fact, is why the ball does not bounce quite to the height from which I dropped it. It's because some of its energy was dissipated in the collision. So energy is being dissipated in the collisions of all these particles. And some of that energy goes into heating up the particles. That's why they get progressively faster in their motions. They heat up. But some of the energy is radiated away. You can see in this diagram, these little squiggly arrows I've drawn, they are there to denote photons escaping from this contracting pre-main sequence star. So the photons are being generated as a release or as a consequence of the release of gravitational energy. Stuff is coming in to a smaller and smaller sphere, emitting gravitational energy. Again, I love to drop the ball because it's just so illustrative of what I'm saying. If I drop it in Earth's gravity, it picks up speed. It's releasing gravitational energy and picking up speed to compensate. So all these particles pick up speed, but then they collide with one another and they radiate part of that collisional energy. All right? Well, eventually, the center of the star heats up so much that nuclear reactions among the nuclei can begin. This happens at a temperature of about 1,000,000 degrees Kelvin, or somewhat more than 1,000,000 degrees Kelvin. The protons, in particular, can collide with each other so vigorously that they stick together. A new type of force, the strong nuclear force, grabs them and holds them together. Even though the protons are positively charged and electrically would repel each other, if the temperatures are sufficiently high, then this repulsion, which normally would move them away from each other at low temperatures, well, the repulsion is overcome by the sheer fact that these things are screaming towards each other. And before the repulsion can slow them down enough, they hit. And in some cases, there's this new force, this strong nuclear force that latches one on to the other. And you get a nucleus that's heavier, more massive than either of the two initial particles. Okay, you get two where you used to have one. That's nuclear energy, and I'll be describing it more later. That release of nuclear energy can compensate for the release of photons from the surface of the star, and therefore the star no longer has to keep contracting to generate the energy that's lost from its surface. It used to be that the star contracted to replace or to generate the energy that's released. But now that energy is being generated not by gravitational contraction, but by nuclear energy. And so the star achieves an equilibrium. It stops contracting because now it is able to maintain its internal heat, its internal motions, and those internal motions, which generate a pressure, can counterbalance the inward force of gravity. Okay? And so the star achieves what we call hydrostatic equilibrium. Hydro, water, static, not moving. The water in your swimming pool is in hydrostatic equilibrium. It is neither contracting nor expanding. It's just sitting there. A balloon. Blown up is in hydrostatic equilibrium. Why? Well, because there's high pressure gas inside. I had to exert a force on this balloon. My lungs had to really fill up to fill this thing. And the gases are moving so quickly in there, the particles are moving so quickly that they're hitting the inside of the rubber and keeping it stretched out. The reason the air inside doesn't blow the balloon apart, at least not until I put a lot more air in, is that the tension in the rubber exerts a counterforce to that. The tension in the rubber is trying to pull the balloon back in on itself. The compressed air inside tries to push the balloon out. Those forces are equal and opposite, and the balloon remains static. If I blow up the balloon some more, the pressure increases and I stretch the rubber more, and the new equilibrium state would be in a more highly stretched state. If I blow it too much, it'll blow up. If I release the air, the pressure inside goes down. So what happens to the balloon? It shrinks. Because as the pressure inside decreases, the tension in the balloon overcomes that decreased pressure and collapses the balloon. But if it's blown up and you tie off the opening, it is in hydrostatic equilibrium. So too does a star achieve this state of hydrostatic equilibrium. And it does this when nuclear reactions start and replenish continually the supply of energy that is lost from the surface of the star. So our sun is in this mechanical hydrostatic equilibrium. It's stable. It will remain that way for many billions of years. Nuclear reactions provide stability for many billions of years because there's enough fuel there to continue supplying the energy that is lost from the surface of the star. And you get this kind of stability. If it were not so, if the nuclear reactions were not occurring, our sun and other stars would continue to contract, and one can calculate that our sun would only live a few tens of millions of years, not the billions of years that it can live with this new source of energy. Well, in some cases, stars or the contracting clouds, which fragment, don't have enough mass to achieve a sufficiently high temperature to ignite nuclear reactions in the core. That mass limit is about 1/12 actually of a solar mass. It's 0.08 solar masses. A pocket of gas, which is less massive than 0.08 solar masses, 8% of the mass of the sun, never achieves a central temperature that's high enough to ignite nuclear reactions. It stops contracting eventually, but that's because of a new type of pressure called degeneracy pressure that comes into play. And I would rather discuss the physics of degeneracy pressure a little bit later on when I talk about white dwarfs. But keep that name in mind. It's not that the gas is morally reprehensible or anything. It's just that this degeneracy pressure is, or degenerate matter is the name that physicists give for this peculiar state of highly compressed matter. I'll talk about it a bit more later. Such objects are called brown dwarfs. Here is a brown dwarf next to a normal star. You can see that the brown dwarf is much, much dimmer than the normal star. It's much smaller, and it doesn't generate energy of its own through nuclear fusion, so it's very, very dim. Here was the Discovery picture made at Palomar Observatory. You can see it's kind of fuzzy, but still shows the star next to its much brighter companion. This is a very challenging observation to make. And here is a Hubble Space Telescope picture, which shows it in greater detail. Okay, well, those brown dwarfs are important because there might be quite a lot of them in our galaxy, and yet they don't shine very much. They're very dim, so they could contribute to the dark matter that we think exists in our galaxy, and I'll have more to say about that later. Here we will only restrict our attention to stars greater than the 0.08 solar mass limit at which they become true stars. So let's discuss what is actually happening in the center of a star. In the center of a star, as I said before, the temperature is very, very high because the gas has been gravitationally contracting. And because of the high temperature, the atoms are fully ionized. Okay? So the electrons are free to roam around wherever they want. And the nuclei are free to roam around in whatever direction they want. They hit each other, they move every which way. But the electrons are not bound in these orbits, quote unquote, these quantum orbits that I discussed when we talked about spectra. This sort of breaks down the shield that normally shields atomic nuclei from each other. Normally, they can't get close to each other because of the electron clouds surrounding them. And indeed, it is the electron clouds that give structure, that give substance to matter. This is what holds us up. This is what holds a piece of wood up. Remember, atoms are mostly empty space. So what gives us any sort of, you know, rigidity? It's the electron clouds repelling each other, all right? But if the electron clouds are no longer kind of there, the electrons are sort of just moving around, the nuclei can actually have a chance to hit each other. And if the temperature is sufficiently high, then the speeds are big enough that the protons don't completely repel each other, but can actually hit each other. And nuclear fusion then occurs. The basic idea is that four protons, four hydrogen nuclei, fuse together to form helium nucleus, plus energy. Where does the energy come from? Well, the helium nucleus is more tightly bound than the original four protons, which are far apart from each other. The helium nucleus, in a very real sense, has less mass than the four protons of which it's made. Actually, the helium nucleus, of course, is two protons and two neutrons. So along the way, two of those protons that come together have to turn into neutrons. I'll discuss that more later, but that's immaterial for right now. The helium nucleus has a smaller mass than the four original protons because it is tightly bound. It's kind of like if I am an electron in a high up energy level and I jump down to a low energy level, I become more tightly bound to the nucleus, and that release of energy is the source of the photon that moves away. If I jump off the table, I've done that a lot of times, I won't do it again right now, I release a photon because I jump down closer to the nucleus and I become more tightly bound. That's an electronic transition. It's a relatively low energy transition. It produces an ultraviolet or a visible or an infrared photon. But nuclei, when they get bound to each other, they're bound by the strong nuclear force. It is 38 orders of magnitude or so stronger than the electromagnetic. No, it's much stronger than electric force, about 100 times stronger than the electromagnetic force. So you get energies, typical energies, that are much higher than the electronic transitions, which are produced by electrons jumping from one level to another. So the typical sort of thing that's emitted is a gamma ray. And how many gamma rays are produced? Well, the energy emitted in this way corresponds to the decrease in mass that occurred when four protons combined with each other in a nuclear sense to form a helium nucleus. That mass deficit turns out to be about 0.7% of the original mass of the protons. So you have four protons sitting on a table. If you squeeze them together to form a helium nucleus, the mass of that helium nucleus is 0.7% less than the mass of the original four protons, because they're bound together. My mass, when I'm standing on a high dive, the mass of the Earth Alex system is actually greater when I'm up on a high dive than when I jump down, because when I jump down, I'm deeper in the gravitational field of the Earth. I'm more tightly bound to the Earth, and my mass, or the mass of the system, actually decreases. And that's what gives rise to my speed, my kinetic energy as I fall. The mass of an object depends on how tightly bound it is, or the mass of a system depends on how tightly bound it is. And so these four protons, tightly bound in a helium nucleus, have less mass than when they were separated. That mass difference, 0.7% of the original mass, gets converted into energy according to Einstein's famous formula, E equals mc squared. Okay? That formula comes from relativity. Here's Monsieur Einstein writing on the blackboard. He did all this work when he was a much younger man than this. But the net result is that you have this famous equation, E equals mc squared, and the energy that's released by this nuclear reaction, four protons combining to form helium, is 0.7% of the original mass of the four helium, four hydrogen nuclei, four protons. So this is the energy that's released by the nuclear reaction. All right? That's what's happening. The energies that are released are big. These gamma rays are energetic because of the great strength of the nuclear force, 100 times stronger than the electromagnetic force. All right. Well, all right, how fast is this happening? In the sun, it turns out to generate the sun's observed energy, you need 700 million tons of protons, of hydrogen nuclei, to be fusing into helium each and every second. Blink, the second went by, 700 million tons of hydrogen just got used up in the sun. Another second goes by, another 700 million tons got converted into helium. That's what I mean by saying used up. Now, only 0.7% of the mass got converted into energy in the process. So most of the mass of the sun remains the same. It gets used up very slowly. But every second, 700 million tons of hydrogen get converted into helium. So there's less and less hydrogen every second in the sun by about 700 million tons. You might say, oh boy, we're really worried, you know. We better go find ourselves another star to orbit, because at that rate, our tank of gas is going to be used up pretty quickly. 700 million tons, you know, that's one big truck, all right? Well, the sun is one big truck. It's got a huge fuel tank. Look at this. It's got plenty of raw material. It's got 330,000 times the mass of the Earth, and 70% of that is hydrogen. So it's got a huge mass. Now, admittedly, you can't use all of the hydrogen in the sun and fuse it to helium. This process is only occurring in the central 10 or 15% of the star's mass. But hey, you know, 10 or 15% of 330,000 times the mass of the Earth is still one big fuel tank. Even at a rate of 700 million tons per second, the sun can continue this process of fusion of hydrogen into helium for about 10 billion years. And that is what it is doing right now. The sun is a huge, stable, controlled nuclear reactor, fusing hydrogen into helium at exactly the rate that it needs in order to maintain hydrostatic equilibrium, to maintain the same size and shape. All main sequence stars are doing this very thing. They're fusing hydrogen to helium, 4 protons to a helium nucleus. The precise reactions depend on the mass of the star and the temperature in the core and all sorts of details, but the basic idea is that 4 protons are being converted into 2 protons and 2 neutrons bound tightly together. And that is how stars shine. Now, the photons take a long time to leak out of the star, about 100,000 years in the case of our sun. Photon gets produced, and it bounces around, because the sun is opaque. And finally, after 100,000 years or more, it leaks out of the sun. So even if you were to turn off the nuclear reactions in the sun right now, we wouldn't know it for a long time, okay? But this is what stars are doing for billions of years, and the more massive stars do it for less time than the less massive stars, okay? Now, why do I say they're controlled nuclear reactors? Well, they're like a thermostat. A thermostat keeps the temperature of your room at the desired level. How does the sun keep itself at the desired level? Well, suppose you were to squish the sun down a little bit. Suppose you were God and you compressed the sun. That would heat its interior. That would increase the vigor of the nuclear reactions. You'd have more protons hitting each other, more energy released. Well, that would heat the star. That would heat the interior. And we know that when gases are heated, they expand. Let me show you a little demo here. Here I have a little bulb with a liquid in it, and it's connected by a little tube to another bulb. I'm going to heat the air in this bulb by holding my fingers next to it, holding my fingers around it. That will expand the gas in the bulb, and its pressure will push the liquid up, causing it to boil. Look at that. It's even, boil. My hands must be cold. Now, there, it boiled a little bit there. Well, anyway, you could see there it goes. The liquid got pressed up into the upper bulb because of the extra pressure exerted by the slightly warmer gas after I heated it with my fingers. So expanding heated gases expand. The extra compression that you gave to the sun increases the vigor of the nuclear reactions. That increases the temperature of the core. That causes the core to expand. Expanding gases cool, and so the sun responds to my putting a pressure cooker on it by expanding a little bit and cooling. And that decreases the rate of nuclear reactions. Okay? If instead I were to expand the star, then nuclear reactions would go down in its core because I cooled the star, I expanded it. That would mean that the pressure in the interior is not sufficient to hold itself up against the relentless force of gravity. That means the star would contract. That would make it heat up, until the nuclear reactions became so strong that it expands again. And so it achieves an equilibrium, the equilibrium that it needs to achieve to stay put. So it burns nuclear fuel at exactly the rate necessary to stay put. All right, well, there's an interesting puzzle in all of this. As part of this reaction of four protons going to a helium nucleus through fusion, you had to convert two of the protons into a neutron. That occurs by the release of a thing called the positron, an anti-electron. It's like an electron, but with a positive charge. So if they shake hands, if they meet, they annihilate and produce a photon, two photons, actually. All right? But they meet and they annihilate. And indeed, the positron that's released through this reaction quickly meets up with an electron and annihilates, producing a gamma ray. And then there's a funny little particle called a neutrino that's also produced. It's given the Greek little letter nu, not to be confused with frequency. The frequency of like light or a wave is also denoted nu. So you just got to know which one you're talking about from the context. So this reaction happens twice as part of the process of fusing four protons to form a helium nucleus. All right, well, the positron annihilates with an electron, producing photons. But the neutrinos are very small. They have almost no mass, if any mass at all. And they're highly non-interactive particles. They're very antisocial. Neutrino means little neutral one. There's a great little poem by John Updike called Cosmic Gall, and it's about neutrinos. And I can't read it right now, but you can look it up. It starts out, neutrinos, they are very small. Okay, they are. They're very small, and they hardly interact at all. And they can zip through the sun unimpeded by all these gases. The gases impede the photons, which take 100,000 years to get out, but neutrinos get out right away. It takes them a little over 2 seconds to fly through the sun, and that's just how long it takes light to go through the sun if light were unimpeded. That's just the speed of light and the distance. That gives you a time. So they go zipping right out. Zoom. All right? They're hardly interactive at all. And a whole slew of these things is produced by the nuclear reactions in the sun. And they travel, if not at the speed of light, then almost at the speed of light. So they are a probe of conditions right now in the center of the sun. If the sun is undergoing nuclear reactions, there had better be a flood of neutrinos produced. So if we could catch a few of them and know what fraction we catch, we could calculate how many neutrinos are being produced in the sun and see whether it conforms with our expectations. How do you catch them? It's tough. They can go through a light year of lead in general. Now, the greater the amount of material, the more of them will get trapped. A few do interact. But in general, one can travel through a light year of lead. But if you have a big underground tank of water or some sort of cleaning solution or some sort of solution which can react with neutrinos, and it's underground to shield you from cosmic rays and stuff, then from the flood of neutrinos expected to be streaming down from the sun, a few might interact, maybe one every few days. And they can produce a radioactive nucleus through the interaction with chlorine. For example, you can form radioactive argon. And that amount of argon can then be detected. The net result of this extremely complex experiment is that the observed number of neutrinos coming from the sun, the observed number of neutrinos, the number of neutrinos in some units, solar neutrino units, is about one-third or so, one-third to one-quarter of the predicted number, according to theory. So here's a bunch of experiments done from 1970 all the way to 1990. They measured the number of neutrinos that they were detecting as a function of time. There's measurement errors, and they kind of oscillate up and down. But you can see that the average is something like a quarter, perhaps, or maybe a third, because the theory is a bit uncertain. You might expect 6 neutrino units. You only observe 2. You know, so it's a third to a quarter of what you expect. And other experiments using other substances also get a deficit, maybe half of the expected number of neutrinos, or maybe two-thirds, but never the expected number. So what's going on? Is the sun really not fusing energy, or fusing nuclei at the rate that we expect? Well, in fact, we have such great confidence in our theory of the solar interior that we instead believe that this is an indication of something about the physical nature of neutrinos. It turns out there are several types of neutrinos, and these experiments only measure the so-called electron neutrinos. There's another type of neutrino called the muon neutrino and the tau neutrino. If neutrinos have a little bit of mass, if they're not massless like photons, then they can transform themselves one to another between the center of the sun and us. So if some of the electron neutrinos have turned into muon neutrinos or tau neutrinos, then our experiments would not be sensitive to them, and we would expect a deficit. We think that the solar neutrino experiment has taught us something fundamental about little particles, neutrinos, and if they have mass, we have to actually change our theories about the fundamental particles to some extent. Very recently, in June of this year, 1998, an independent experiment, which more directly measures the convulsion of one or the transformation of one neutrino into another, it has successfully measured this transformation, suggesting that neutrinos really do have mass. So it looks like the sun really is producing a lot of neutrinos, but some of them are changing their type, their shape along the way, and that's why we're not detecting all of them.